We're just coming off the Labor Day weekend. The Hotel Workers Union here in Waikiki, as well as on the mainland, took to the streets yesterday in an effort to flex its political muscle. In San Francisco, police arrested 75 people during yesterday's rally in front of a Marriott Union Street hotel. In Boston, workers staged a sit-in on a city street, although there were no arrests there. And a similar effort was tried in Waikiki, but United Here workers ended up gathering on Kalakaua across from the Waikiki Marriott, where union leaders announced they will take a strike vote on September 10th. The union represents thousands of hotel workers across major properties in Waikiki and across the state. The contracts expired June 30th. Local 5 leader Eric Gill is calling on Marriott and Kyoya, which operate the largest properties in Waikiki, to settle the labor contracts.
They're making record profits. The industry is doing well. It's not fair to get that big tax break and all that they got from the federal government that we didn't get, they have to share.
Fair is fair.
We want our share.
Fair is fair.
We want our share.
Local 5 said its last bargaining session with Marriott was Friday. It meets with Kyoya at the end of the week. Similar rallies were also held in San Diego, Detroit, and Seattle. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we hike into the botanical backyard to test your knowledge of Hawaii's flora. In the late 1800s, a flowering plant believed to be from India arrived in Hawaii. The blossom comes in various shades, ranging from white to lavender to violet. It's said to have been the favored flower of Queen Liliuokalani and is today still prized by laymakers for its long-lasting blooms. This flowering shrub loves sun and sandy soil and can be found in some of the older neighborhoods of Honolulu, but it's not nearly as common in the islands as it once was. The dwindling number of these plants saddens laymakers, but they're not the only ones who seek out this plant. This plant is desperately needed for the survival of an insect in our islands. Our part two question, what's this flowering plant and what depends on it as its sole food source? You think you know? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 with the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, the former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, and author of the bestseller, Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. And you're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Find our stories on Twitter or tweet us at HI Conversation.
This weekend's fire in Brazil's National Museum hit home as the news that a Hawaiian feather cape was housed there. HPR's Kuvei Hirishi joins us live with the story.
Aloha, Catherine. Yes.
Oh, this is so sad.
It was, and I think everyone got the news that this fire was burning 200-year-old institution in Rio, millions of artifacts. And then to hear that we actually had a Hawaiian feather cloak there, I think kind of shook a lot of folks. But so a little bit history on this cloak, how it got to Brazil back in 1823. So a long time ago, King Kamehameha II, Liholiho, was en route to London to meet with, to try to gain an audience with King George IV at the time to sort of, this was the first time he ever left or any of our kings had left to kind of have that one-on-one relationship with anyone. But while they were en route to London, they took an 18-day detour to Rio, which was interesting. There's really no reason why, a known reason why he had done that. But while he did, he had a chance to meet with the Brazilian Emperor Dom Pedro while he was there. And he was actually received really, really warmly, which was odd because they, you know, not too many people knew about Hawaii at the time.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Noel Kahanu, American Studies faculty up at UH Manoa, joined us to kind of give us an idea of what happened during that exchange.
When they greet one another, there's an exchange of gifts. And so King Liholiho receives a diamond-encrusted sword with a gold sheath. His wife, Kamalmalu, receives a pair of diamond earrings. And Liholiho, in turn, presents the emperor with a feather cloak and a kahili.
So we do not yet know about the whereabouts of the sword and earrings. Like, hopefully we can find out about that. But we do know that the feather cloak, this ahuula, remained in the hands of the Brazilian government and was housed in the museum. No confirmation yet on whether or not that was damaged in the fire. We do know 90% of the artifacts in the museum right now have perished, but waiting to hear about that. It's an interesting function, though, that these ahuula, these capes and cloaks played sort of in the late 1700s, early 1800s. We've got a ton of these in museums around the world. Because our ali'i had used them sort of as a government function to solidify that relationship with other countries, with other captains of ships, and sort of show a goodwill towards someone. It was something that they actually did. But when you think about it possibly burning in this fire, it's one of those things where, okay, what do we do next? Should we be a little bit more proactive about going out there to find them? Should we be talking to other museums? But the vast, to give us sort of a bigger picture about what's out there, it's not just the cloaks and the capes. There are a lot of other feather work out there. And Noel shares us a little bit about that.
Over 50 cloaks, 100 capes, and 60 mahiole are known to exist all over the world. We do have some here in Hawaii, but the vast majority exists in private and public museums throughout the world, and then a very small portion is held in private hands.
That's right. So mahiole were those helmets, but all of it very intricate feather work, I'd say, in this particular ahuula that's thought to be at the Brazil Museum. We're talking 20,000 birds would have been captured to remove the feathers from them and then make the cape itself with something like 50,000 feathers. So very intricate handiwork and something really treasured, I think, for the cultural experience that it had. But in the giving that posing that question about whether or not we go and repatriate them, so folks might have remembered back in, was it 2016, that colonial pu'u cloak that was brought back from big ceremony, brought back from the Te Papa Museum in New Zealand. That was sort of that first interaction with New Zealand to say, okay, we know you have this feather cloak of ours. We want to bring it back and do this official ceremony so that we can kind of honor that relationship. So when we think about not just bringing these cloaks back, but forging that same relationship that Liholiho tried to forge back in the day with Dom Pedro over in Brazil. I think those are some of the conversations we're going to start seeing as these things unfold. So what Noel was saying that was really interesting was, you know, if we really want to pay tribute and honor the legacy of the Ali'i, is it going to be problematic when we ask for these things back, you know? Or do we just keep it there and try to forge that stronger relationship? But she worked at the museum, Bishop Museum, for a while before this and sort of had a her own reflection on what this fire meant for the museum community.
I think that probably everyone in the museum field who woke up to that news or who saw that news shuddered in horror. And this is a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call for every institution. We have to ask ourselves, I think, even for us, what if we woke up the next morning and Bishop Museum burned to the ground?
Those are, you know, it's a really deep conversation and something that I think all museums, including our own Bishop Museum, will really be looking at the next couple of days.
Clarify for me, though, if this was something that was presented as a gift, you know, that the Ali'i gave freely and they received a gift in exchange, why would we repatriate these things? I can see if, you know, there were archaeologists who went and took bones and funeral objects, that kind of thing. This is a little bit different, so explain to me.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and that's the point that Noel had made as well. It's whether or not we don't want to question our Ali'i's intentions in gifting that, so we're not going to ask for all of these cloaks back. But in some instances, the chain of custody, but the way that something got to a place is still a little murky, and those kinds of, in those instances, sort of having that conversation again with these museums and with these other countries is really something that we're going to see.
Right. And again, the whole conversation about, are we doing enough to guard our treasures?
Exactly. And I see a lot of folks kind of starting those discussions. You know, some are saying we want to bring it back, but others are saying, well, this was a gift. So it's going to be an ongoing discussion. But unfortunately, it had to happen from this fire.
Right. Well, hopefully we can all learn from it.
Yes.
Thanks so much. That was Kuvehi Hiraishi with the Hawaii link to a fire at Brazil's National Museum. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Blaise Lovell is a reporting fellow for Honolulu Civil Beat and has a follow-up story to an incident that happened, an explosion at the University of Hawaii laboratory that severely injured a researcher. Good morning, Blaise.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me today.
I remember this fire. That was like, 2 years ago, right?
Right. It was in March of 2016.
Yeah, terrible. The researcher lost her arm in that.
She did indeed. The Hawaii Fire Department and the University of California both conducted independent investigations, and the University of California team found that it was caused by the improper use of a digital pressure gauge on one of the gas cylinders that was being used for research there.
And she ultimately sued the university.
She did. She first filed suit in January of 2017. Now her attorneys are filing a petition with the Hawaii Supreme Court to keep the case in a lower trial court.
So what's that issue?
So the issue here is a kind of complex dispute over employment. Now, when Dr. Thea Eakins-Coward, that's the injured researcher, when she first began researching at the University of Hawaii, to her understanding, she was not an employee. She didn't receive benefits. And in fact, the university made that quite clear to her, her attorneys told me. But after the incident, UH showed her this policy that said, well, you're not an employee except for cases of workers' compensation. So in this case, because she was injured on university property, they want her to pursue restitution through workers' comp.
Wow, so that's a really interesting issue. It makes you wonder if that'll have like a chilling effect, you know, on attracting researchers, or even when our researchers go off to other universities?
It could. I couldn't speak to how much of a chilling effect it might have, but there's a lot of questions here, especially if the Supreme Court were to take on this case, depending on how wide or how narrow they decide to rule, if they decide to rule at all on it.
So what's the process? Walk us through what has to happen next.
So basically earlier this year, one of the circuit court judges ruled in the university's favor, saying that this is an issue of employment, and the director of labor relations would need to make a decision as to whether or not Dr. Eakins-Coward was or was not an employee of the UH. Eakins-Coward's attorneys filed a petition with the Supreme Court to stop that decision coming from the director of labor relations to keep this in the trial court. The big point here, and this is what the attorneys told me, they believe that getting her to take workers' compensation might be a safer route for the university rather than having to deal with a lawsuit.
And she did have her medical costs covered by insurance, right?
Yes, that's correct. Part of her medical costs were covered by the First Insurance Company of Hawaii, which is the university's workers' comp adjuster.
And the university also got fined as a result of this incident.
Yes, they were fined, I believe, about $69,000 by the state of Hawaii. They were forced to implement different safety procedures. And in fact, since 2016, a lot of the recommendations that came from the team from California have been implemented to make labs safer for researchers right now.
Right. And that's really important. I mean, gosh, because when you think of all the work that is being done in labs, not just here in Hawaii, but across the country, safety really needs to be paramount.
It was. And that was a big concern on the investigation team's minds. You know, earlier in 2016, they said that UH needed to develop a culture of safety at the university. And it appears that they have. You know, this isn't just a problem at UH. There were some lab incidences in California, in Arizona. UH has said that they want to be the leader in lab safety moving forward.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Blaise. Really fascinating issue. And it'd be interesting to see what happens and how far this goes. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was reporting fellow Blaise Lovell with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
We were able to take whatever we could carry in our two hands.
At the beginning of World War II, the United States government forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans into prison camps.
We thought we were American citizens, therefore we were protected by the Constitution to continue to have the freedom, the liberty that all Americans have a right to.
Listen for Order 9066 from APM Reports.
Saturday at 4 p.m.
Are you a team player looking to join a championship team? HPR has openings for positions in our membership and finance departments. See the job descriptions and requirements for the part-time events and outreach assistant and the part-time accounting assistant on the Hawaii Public Radio website or Facebook pages. We look forward to hearing from you.
Support for The Conversation comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 25 years of support for Hawaii Public Radio. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
mention Jake Shimabukuro's name, and the idea of explosive talent comes to mind. He has two young children, about 3 and 6 now, and he recalled that he first put his fingers on an ukulele when he was about their age. We sat down with him last week as he debuted Greatest Day, his latest album, his 15th.
It's kind of a follow-up to my last record, which was Nashville Sessions. And that was an all-original, you know, my first all-original record. It was very experimental, pretty out there. You know, so I wanted to kind of find a good balance of, you know, the traditional sound and then the electric sound, of course. So with this new album, you know, we also I also wanted to balance the original material with recognizable stuff. So there's six original songs and 6 cover tunes. Some of the cover tunes include, you know, pieces by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. Remember the Zombies? Time of the Season. We did. We even did some more. A tune from the 80s called "Bizarre Love Triangle" by a group called New Order. And it's a little more my time. And then we also did an Ed Sheeran tune called "Shape of You." So it covered a little bit of everything. And I think to me the greatest compliment came from my parents after I got the CD, the final mix. I gave one to my mom and one to my dad, and they both told me that this is their favorite record.
Wow.
Of mine. So I was like, oh, you know, I'm a, you know, grown man now, but you know, you still want the approval from your parents, and you still want to, you know, you want them to approve of what you're doing.
Yeah,
so.
Well, they're proud of their boy.
That made me feel really good. So.
You know, I have to say that one song, the $5 Unleaded.
Oh yeah.
I just love that story.
Really?
I just love the thought that you actually, you know, captured that time in your life and your dad.
My dad's old green beat up truck that we used to drive around. Yeah, gas is not $5. It's like $5 a gallon now. But back then it was like $5 almost filled up, you know, half his tank at least. So
do you remember when, you know, you were little and you were just messing around on the ukulele, and
you know,
did you ever think that this would develop into, you know, what it has today?
I do remember the first time I picked it up. You know, I was 4 years old and my mom played, so she sat me down and taught me, you know, she put my fingers on the strings and she told me, okay, just hold the string right there and then strum that, that's your C chord. And I remember just playing that over and over, and I just fell in love with the sound. And but you know, I always loved it. So I learned from her in the beginning, but then when I was about 6 years old, she sent me to Roy Sukuma's ukulele studio. So I went there for about at least 5 or 6 years. And then after that, I also went to, I started learning from other players like Herb Alta Jr. I went to Tracy Tirada. Byron Yasui was another big influence for me. Gordon Mark. I mean, just so many, Kelly Boyd de Lima, you know, all those guys really took me under their wing and just kind of showed me, you know, their approach, their perspective, their technique. And so I feel very fortunate. I had so many people to kind of mentor me and just kind of help me along the way.
So what do you think, because you have kids now too, right?
Yes.
So what do you think about that when you play and...
Well, the thing is, I want them to have an appreciation for music and the arts, you know, because I think that's very important. I don't ever want to pressure them into playing or performing or anything like that, because my parents never pressured me. You know, it was something that I always wanted to do, but they always gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, to try different things, right? So I think that's the most important thing. But I think the ukulele, it really helped me, you know, through some of the harder times in my life, like when my parents went through their divorce. You know, I was only in the 5th grade. And at that time, you know, you're going through all these different emotions and, you know, you're dealing with things that you've never really felt before. So it was a confusing time for me. And I didn't have a lot of, I had a few friends, but this was when I was at Alawai Elementary School.
Okay.
But I wasn't a talker. I was the type I would hold everything in. And the ukulele really helped me, because I could sit in my room and play, you know, I could just play chords or play songs, And it helped me to channel those emotions, you know, out and release some of the things that I was feeling in a very positive way. So I think it helped me through a lot, you know, through those times. Much like talking, right? Like when you talk to a friend and you tell them, oh, I'm going through this right now, talking to them helps. But it's not so much the words, but it's the emotion that's coming out. So when you're playing an instrument and you're playing music, that's what it is. You know, it's the language of human emotion. So as you're playing, you know, you're just, all of this emotion is flowing out of you, and it helps, you know, it helps to heal. It's therapeutic. And I think I owe a lot to the ukulele.
And I know you've taken ukulele playing to a whole nother level from when I grew up and was, you know, listening to ukulele music. And I read somewhere that, is it Hallelujah? Is that one of the...
Yeah, Hallelujah is a track on the new song, yes.
Yeah, and you said you recorded it, but then after Leonard Cohen died, you wanted to play it again.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always been one of my favorite pieces of music. And I recorded it years ago, but after Leonard Cohen had passed away, I started performing it in my concerts again, right? And I have a new trio that I'm playing with, a guy from Nashville named Nolan Werner on bass, and a guy from Denver, Colorado. His name is Dave Preston. He plays guitar. So we came up with an arrangement and started performing at the shows, you know, as a dedication to Leonard Cohen. And it just took on a whole another, I mean, it almost felt like a different song, you know, because it just comes from a different place emotionally. So I just thought, man, it'd be kind of cool to, you know, re-record it. And then, you know, so that's what we did. And it really captures a different kind of energy, I think. You know, recently there were so many great musicians who we lost, you know. I mean, Eddie Kamai, you know, who was the ultimate ukulele maestro. He was my biggest inspiration. You know, when he passed away, it was like, wow, you know, digging up all his old recordings and listening to that. Or like when the Cruz brothers, you know, when we lost Ernie Cruz and Guy Cruz. I used to play in a band with Guy Cruz, and Ernie, when he was with the Kyle Creator Boys, you know, they were a huge inspiration for me, you know. So, you know, we recently lost Peter Moon, another ukulele player that was just so influential. And I mean, prior to him, nobody was doing anything that he was doing, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was really, you know, so yeah, like you said, you know, going back and listening now after they're gone, it's just you listen to it in a different way. There's a whole new appreciation, and it does, it affects you deeper, you know, emotionally. So
Hallelujah is on the track.
Yeah, so Hallelujah is on the track. I mean, and it's funny, you know, because that song, for me, there's just something about that tune that just tugs at my, you know, my heartstrings or whatever. But, you know, versus covering a, you know, we also covered If Six Was Nine, you know, Jimi Hendrix, who, again, was just another iconic artist. But, you know, covering a song like that, interestingly, it's emotionally, it's just different, you know, because the song comes from a different place. And even though he passed away, right, and a lot of people were saddened by his passing, but I think a lot of it has to do with the music that they write, you know. So Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah just has a special place, I think, for us emotionally. You know, so I think no matter if he were still alive or, you know, or whatever, anyone who covers that song, it just comes from a special place. And that's the power of composition, the power of just true artistry, right?
And you've called this album The Greatest Day, and you made a reference to a day when you were in the studio and things just clicked.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, well, one of the things is, you know, just being in the studio with everyone, just being around all this, you know, just everyone who's just so passionate about what they're doing. They just have so much joy, and we're all doing what we love, smiling, laughing, having a great time. You know, that's like, to me, I don't know, it's just such a wonderful feeling, you know, to be able to do something that you absolutely love with people who absolutely love, you know, doing it with you, and you create, you're creating something together. It's such a magical feeling.
And was that on your first try?
Actually, all of the songs were all full takes. So we played them live, right? They were all live takes. And then what we did after we laid down, you know, after the drummer, the bass player, the guitar player, myself, after we played and we played through the whole song, we would do it like two or three times. And then we would listen to each one and we take the one that we like. Like, for example, Time of the Season on there. There's, the Zombies Time of the Season. When we played that, we played it. I believe that's the first take of the song. So we played it. It just felt so good, you know. And then what we did was we later, after we recorded the, you know, our parts, right? And we, you know, we did our thing. Then we would listen to the track and we'd think, oh, okay, well, let's bring in some keys or let's bring in this and that. And we started adding, you know, more elements to it, more sonic elements after the fact. So it's still captured the energy of a live performance. It feels like a live, you know, like a live show or something. The energy is there, but you still have the control of being in the studio. You have a great sounding room with amazing, you know, equipment in there, you know, to modify the sounds of the instrument and to warm them up and make them sound more more pleasing to the ear and more musical.
Well, I remember reading about the Beatles' early hits and how they would just go in the studio and first take, and that, you know, it's just amazing.
Those guys were not human, you know, because, I mean, if you think about all the music that they wrote and created, and then also not just the music, but, you know, lyrically, I mean, their lyrics were incredible. Just all of the different innovations that they brought to how we approach modern day recording. You know, they would do things like they would, put microphones in like a barrel and they would spin it around
to
get different kinds of effects, mm-hmm. right? They would do all these kinds of weird things but you know, they were just so far ahead of their time. And
well, I think a lot of people would say you are too.
No way.
Well, can you play something for us?
Sure, you know? I'd love to. Oh, speaking of the Beatles, we did cover a Beatles song on this record. So we covered Eleanor Rigby. And one of my favorite musicians, Jerry Douglas, who's a wonderful dobro player, actually joined us on a couple tracks on this record. So this is one that he also played with us. But here's Eleanor Rigby. Thank you.
That was Jake Shimabukuro sharing a tune from his just-released album, The Greatest Day. He kicks off his concert tour in Colorado this month.
Aloha, I'm Bianca Dukeshir from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, when there's a really nasty pest that you want to get rid of, it might seem sensible to offer a cash bounty, yeah?
When you introduce an incentive scheme, you have to just admit to yourself that no matter how clever you think you are, there's a pretty good chance that someone far more clever than yourself will figure a way to beat the incentive scheme.
Next time on Freakonomics Radio, the Cobra Effect.
This evening at 7.
On the next On Being, deepening the experience of life and the hospitable form of words that is prayer.
The world is big and wide and wild and wonderful and wicked, and our lives are murky, magnificent, malleable, and full of meaning. Oremus, let us pray.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Sunday morning at 10.
In today's backyard quiz, we went looking for a shrub in people's garden, popular to both laymakers and monarch butterflies. This plant enjoys bright sun and hates having roots sitting in water, so it's best grown in well-draining soil. Healthy plants produce light green leaves about the size of your palm and blooms that range in color. They come in white or purple. And the sap, or the milk of the plant, is a sticky skin irritant and toxic in large doses. So laymakers take special care when harvesting the flowers. The crown flower, also known as a giant milkweed, happens to be the only plant in our state that our monarch caterpillars feed on. Now, since there are fewer and fewer of these plants grown in Hawaii, you might consider adding this plant to your garden to help maintain monarch populations. And congratulations to Vicky of Kailua. You got it right. And special thanks to Sean Carberry for planting the seed for today's backyard quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Scores of high-rises are planned for Oahu's urban core, and starting October 1st, anyone who develops a unit that could impact schools in the area will be assessed an impact fee of $3,800. We talked to the Department of Education's Dan Carlson of the Facilities Branch about this change.
It'll only impact people that are putting a potential impact on our school system. So the way it works is at the time someone pulls a permit to build a dwelling unit, that is when they will also be told that this fee is being applied to them. And if you're a single, you know, single builder, single, you know, you're just building one, then they would actually be working that out. They'd send a check directly over to our department here, and we deposit that in a special account that'll go to specifically that district and be used in that area for potential impacts on our school system. And the fee is actually designed around the cost of the land value that it would take to build the school, and then 10% of the building cost. So there's pressure from our legislators. When they came out with the rail and started the transit-oriented development, the speculation is in this region here, this Kalihita-Alamoana corridor, there could be an additional 39,000 units built. Now, how far out that is, 20, 30 plus years, they may never get there to 39,000. But what this allowed us to do is to establish a fee based on the impact that those additional units would have on our schools. Because if this whole thing builds out to the capacity that they're talking about, we anticipate needing 1.5 new high schools, 1.5 new middle schools, and potentially up to 6 new elementary schools if and when it gets to that point. But again, we only pull the fee when someone pulls a permit to build a unit. So if we never get to 39,000, obviously those fees will not. It's not like we're charging for 39,000 upfront so that we can build schools. It's basically a pay as the system continues to grow.
And right now on the books, we've got one school on the drawing board, there by Mother Waldron.
We do, and that was kind of a. That was a whole other issue. We need a school in that area. We had land in that area. The opportunity came up for us to, there's another thing out there called Act 155, which is something that we're working on where we can offer the land, but we're working with HHFDC on that project to build, yes, a school down on a property that we used to have in Poakina. It'll be the first vertical school that we really build, an elementary school. We're joint using Mother Waldron Park as well for, again, the recess kind of PE type activities. Again, it's a brand new concept certainly for Hawaii.
Right, but the idea about that is that it's a vertical school, and so I would imagine that the other schools that are built in this area would also go up.
Yes, and we anticipate that. So something that we did change, so I talked about how do you get to that fee. To be honest, this fee is lower than the others across the state. And it's because in the process of going through this, we did come to the realization there's no way, for example, for a high school, we're going to get another 45 acres downtown. We realize that. So what we did was we actually changed our board policy and added what we're calling an urban exception, which reduced the land need for a new high school, new elementary school, to, again, what is more of a vertical school kind of concept. When we initially did this analysis and did the fee analysis for this impact fee district, it was substantially more, upwards of around $9,000 as opposed to the $3,800 that we're at right now.
And I recall your predecessor, I think, had gone to various locations on the mainland to look at these new century schools.
Correct. And we even more recently, some of my facilities development branch folks, they did take a trip to, as we were designing this one in Poakina, just to better understand how do we do that. Because it's a new concept. It's something new that some of our teachers and administrators are going to have to get used to. But again, it really is, it'll be a 21st century school for sure.
And I know at one time the DOE was looking at other parcels that they've got in that area. There was some discussion about using a portion of McKinley High School to put on additional school on the grounds there next to the Blaisdell Center. Where are those talks?
We're actually working on our strategic facilities master plan because we recognize all of those schools down in that area were. I'm under pressure to try and monetize through this Act 155 excess land that we have. Obviously, land values down in that area are the highest in the state. So it makes sense if we're going to do that, I'm going to try and monetize something like that, that it would make sense to do it in the urban corridor area there. At the same time, we also know we have this potential need for land to build these schools out. So we're trying to develop kind of a master plan as to how are we going to use all these different pieces of property. What you're alluding to, though, is a concept that we just kind of threw out there as far as, hey, here's a concept, here's an idea. If we had to build another high school, we've got a stretch along Pensacola right next to McKinley High School that, again, we could take a substantial amount of land there, build vertical in that area to again, build another school in an area like that. At this time, though, nothing is set in stone. We're completely, you know, these are just ideas that we're throwing out there. We don't have the demand on our high schools or our middle schools in that area right now, so we have excess capacity. As this does start to build out and we do gain revenue from the impact fees, then obviously that's something that we'd be looking at. But those properties, though, down in those areas, we're under pressure under this Act 155 to try and monetize those. So we're coming out with some other ideas on on how to do that, and that's just kind of a different front. But yes, everybody has their eyes on all of those properties down there because, again, land is going to be a premium as they build out the transient-oriented development. So we did go to public hearing. We did the standard. We're going to do multiple meetings, public hearings, and whatnot. The turnout actually at the public hearings was fairly minimal. I mean, one of the things we heard in the feedback sessions were, for example, for affordable housing and whatnot. And we have those communities out there that don't think the impact fee should apply to them. I'll tell you from the DOE's perspective, we are leaving that up to our policymakers, our legislators, to determine that. And it's something that each leg season has been brought up and discussed every leg season for the last three or four since we've been working on this. The DOE recognizes the, you know, affordable housing issue. But at the same time, each year the legislators have decided to not put an exemption in for affordable housing. So again, that is clearly their decision. We will follow their lead on that. We understand the issue around affordable housing, but we kind of remain agnostic on whether or not they should have an exemption. If a developer is coming in to build a large tower and they're going to have more than 50 units, then there is a requirement for them to come meet with us and we can discuss with them how we're going to execute this and how we can maybe make provisions. For example, and I'm just kind of throwing this out, if a developer came to us and said, hey, I want to build this, you know, tower and we want to put, you know, low-income type of housing in it or whatnot, but I'll give you room for a school and I'll build a school and integrate it into this building, we could reach an agreement like that that, again, there would not be impact fees then or they would be adjusted appropriately for a tower like that. That's exactly what has happened out, for example, in Ho'opili. We're working right now on designing another high school for out there, but that land for Ho'opili was donated by the developer. The high school, there's a high school lot out there, there's a middle school lot, and I believe three elementary schools in the Ho'opili subdivision alone, where all of that land was donated by the developer.
Any other thought to include parks, playgrounds?
Well, I would say with the Pohokaina Elementary School, that was a great opportunity for us to design in, you know, right next to Mother Waldron Park. I think as we expand our Act 155 stuff and we're looking at uses of schools and whatnot, I mean, we may end up opening up some land in some of those areas. We would obviously look at other areas where we have parks that we can maybe do something joint like that with, but that's obviously in coordination with the Parks and Rec Department. But yeah, I mean, again, it'll be interesting to see this thing develop out, and we're excited about the opportunity.
That was DOE's Dan Carlson talking about new impact fees for public education for public schools that kicks in next month.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, an update on the volcano. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Record your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, check our conversation page on HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Do join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.